below. Several more soldiers fell from the cliffs, their screams lost on the wind, before the only noise was the clank of shields and armour jostling for position, and the plink of arrowheads bouncing off iron. Gwendolen's shield was long and narrow, and they huddled behind it, so close that Roan could taste her breath on his tongue. "What do we do?" he asked, regaining his own breath. "Wait." Eventually the archers paused, realizing the surprise of their initial assault had lost its effectiveness. A cry went up from the cliffs, some kind of bird call, and it travelled down the line away from them. "A warning to the northern defenders," Gwendolen said. "Even if we make it through the pass, they'll be ready for us. The element of surprise is lost." "What am I doing here?" Roan asked himself, as a second wave of arrows, these ones on fire, rained from above. "I am no warrior. I hate war." "I'm here so Gareth doesn't have to die," he reminded himself. "I'm here because he doesn't deserve to die." A burst of flame ripped past his ear, so close he could feel the heat. He shook his head, rattling the thoughts away. Regardless of why he was in this exact place at this exact time, whether by some twisted stroke of fate, plain bad luck, or because of a random series of foolish choices, it was not the time to be philosophical. "On my mark, we will rise as one," Gwendolen hissed. "Hold my shield and stay behind its edges." Roan felt like a child, a burden to the true, highly trained warriors within the battalion. Even if he wanted to, he couldn't save anyone from a fall from the cliffs, skin mark or not. "Now," Gwendolen said, bursting to her feet. Roan pushed himself up beside her, keeping his head down and holding the weight of her shield, which was surprisingly light despite its size. Gwendolen didn't waste a moment, extracting her bow from where it hung on her back. She fitted arrows to the string in short succession, firing two at a time, a feat Roan had once seen in competition, but never in real life. Then again, he'd never been in the midst of a real battle before. There were shouts from above, but Roan didn't know whether they were a result of Gwendolen's shots. Knowing her, she'd probably hit her targets every time. Down the line, other archers in the company were shooting at the cliffs too, aiming for the flashes of fire each time a flaming arrow was lit by the enemy. "Dead men falling!" someone yelled. Roan risked a peek past the edge of the shield, just in time to dodge a corpse that tumbled past, nearly taking off his head. Even dead, their enemies were dangerous from the high ground.
"Forward, march!"
a voice bellowed, and Roan found himself pleased to recognize the king's gruff tone. Somehow it invigorated him, sending hope to his cold bones and tired muscles. The battalion moved forward, quicker now, their eyes fully adjusted to the darkness, assisted by dozens of fire arrows sticking up from the snow, lighting the trail. The occasional arrow still rocketed from above, but they were few and far between. As the trail started to widen once more, Roan began to think it all felt too easy. That's when the first boulders tumbled down the mountainside.
"Look out!"
someone shouted. Everyone craned their heads to look, not that it mattered. The boulder was enormous, bouncing and rolling and gaining momentum as it plunged from above, pushed past the tipping point by the northerners. Those in its direct path tried to scatter, but there was nowhere to go, hemmed in on both sides by their own allies. And yet it wasn't they who died, because at the last moment the boulder split in half, each jagged piece changing direction wildly. Those in its initial direct path were spared, while the soldiers on either side were hit head-on. Dozens of men and women, humans and Orians, were crushed. Roan's heart was in his throat, the horrifying image flashing in his mind in the eerie silence that followed, just before there was the crack of ice and a heavy splash. And that was only the first boulder. Dozens more rolled down the mountain, splitting and changing direction, eliminating soldiers in a seemingly random fashion. Not knowing what else to do, Roan hunkered down tight against the cliff face. Luckily, the mountainside above him had a cleft in its shoulder. At least two boulders literally flew directly over his head, appearing to move in slow motion. Gwendolen was tight beside him, her expression fierce and determined. "It's your turn," she said, as another boulder arced past. Roan stared at her.
Turned to do what? Don't you hear their cries?
In truth, Roan couldn't hear anything but the roaring of blood through his veins, her voice in his ear, and the occasional crack of stone hitting ice. He cocked his head to the side and listened intently, the sounds slowly coming into focus. Men and women in agony, pleading for help, or perhaps to be put out of their misery.
"I hear them," he said.
"Will you answer their call?" Gwendolyn asked.
"I have made my choice. Have you?"
Before he could respond, she was already gone, leaving him with her shield and a decision to make. For Roan, it was no decision at all. Not any more. He'd made the choice on the frozen river the night before.
34. The Northern Kingdom. Raiders Pass. Anise Garrick.
Anise awoke with a start. She listened intently, initially only hearing her own breathing. Then, the shriek of a bird call in the distance, answered by another, then another, rolling down the line until the calls were within their encampment. They were under attack. She sat up quickly, thrusting the thick blanket away from her. She pushed to her feet, already dressed and ready. The spare armour she'd been fitted with was snug against her thick trousers and greatcoat. Her tent flap opened, and the armoured knight filled the entrance. In this moment, she could discern none of the boy named Terin she'd once known. He was truly the monster he believed himself to be, a towering armed warrior with death in his eyes. Anise reached for the sword by her bedroll, but Terin said,
"Princess, you are to stay here in safety. I will defend you to my death."
Though his intentions were honourable, a spark of anger flared up inside her.
"For my mother," she said,
her voice heavy with sarcasm.
"For you,"
Terin said huskily.
Frozen hell,
Anise thought. She ignored the snow flurries in her stomach and took a step forward.
"I don't need defending," she said. "Either you fight alongside me, or you do not fight at all. Just don't accidentally hit me with your hell-frozen morning star."
For a second she thought he was going to hold her hostage in her tent, so she added,
"I'm the Bear Slayer, remember? You said it yourself."
She didn't remind him that she had only scared the ice bear away, not killed it. With a short bob of his head, Terin moved aside, and Anise strode out into the frozen night. The sword felt unwieldy in her grip, and her hand was already aching from holding the weapon too tightly. She tried to relax, loosening her fingers. She wasn't about to admit she was scared, nor that she was no sword fighter. If it came down to it, she would do what she had to survive. Somewhere in the distance, she could see the occasional flame arc through the darkness, landing in the pass between the mountains. She watched one of the fire arrows the whole way, until it hit something and stopped. There was a brief moment when there was only darkness, like the flame had been snuffed out in a snowdrift, but then flames burst in all directions, taking shape. The burning shape was that of a human. The victim staggered, stumbled, and then fell, vanishing from sight. All around her, soldiers were on the move, pushing toward the front lines, preparing to carry out her brother's war plan if necessary. Beside her, Terin said,
"I would be honoured to fight alongside you."
He held the chain of his morning star in one hand, the steel links curling around his neck, the barbed ball dangling in front of his chest.
"Just don't get in my way,"
Anise growled. But it was an act. She'd never seen real battle. And the thing with the ice bear was nothing more than adrenaline and dumb luck, both of which she'd need on her side before this night was over. The only man she'd ever killed was the one who Terin had paralyzed. As one, they slipped into the stream of soldiers moving into position. That's when the first of the ice slings unleashed their payloads. At the same time, Anise saw an unearthly burst of light from the pass. Roan, moments earlier. The northerners were rolling barrels that had once been filled with water down the hill. Now, in the cold, they were completely frozen and as deadly as battering rams. Roan had watched one woman a mere arm's length away get hit by one. She hadn't even had time to scream before she was gone. One crashed down from above, and Roan ducked, feeling a whoosh of air as it swept past his head. A narrow miss, which made Roan wonder for the 100th time whether he'd made the wrong decision in pressing forward in the direction Gwendolyn had gone. So much for being my protector, he thought. Not that he'd ever have the opportunity to inform King Ironclad of his dissatisfaction with her services. Still, he moved onwards, trying to find someone he could help. The bodies he did find lodged on the trail, however, were unmoving. He checked them one at a time, but there was no life within them. Some were incredibly young, barely more than children, while others were old and grizzled, and had likely seen more battles than Roan had seen name days. Several of the dead were Orions, their flawless skin and strangely coloured eyes so out of place amongst the carnage and ice. Roan had just finished checking one such warrior when he heard a new sound, a rumble, almost like thunder, emanating from above. "What new torture is this?" Roan wondered, gazing at the hillside. Long, dark shapes tumbled down the slope, bouncing and changing direction, scattering hither and thither. "Timber," Roan realized. Entire tree trunks, stripped of branches and limbs, rolled from high above in an avalanche of wood. Whilst boulders and barrels cut a relatively narrow path of destruction, this new weapon used broad killing strokes and would be nearly impossible to dodge. As if to illustrate his thoughts, one massive log took out a dozen soldiers just ahead of him. Roan froze, unable to move, bound to the cliff by indecision. He glanced right as another tree barreled down the hill. Unless it changed course drastically, it would land somewhere near him. He forced his feet to move, charging forwards even as he could feel the log closing in from the side, a dark shape bucking and writhing, creaking and hammering. At the last possible moment he dove, half-tripping on another soldier who lay prostrate on the trail. Pain erupted in his calf as the end of the log clipped his leg, shattering bone and tearing muscle. He moaned, landing on sharp rocks that protruded like lances from the packed snow. Rolling in agony on the path, he used his life mark, which began to warm his chest, fingers of healing stretching toward his injury. Nearby, the soldier he'd assumed was dead groaned. He or she was still alive. The blood of innocence cried out to him. Why? Why? Why did you heal me only to let him burn us alive? No, Roan growled between his teeth. That was long ago, and his guardian was long dead. Markin Swansea couldn't hurt Roan any more. And Roan had healed that girl with the pox, back in Glee. She was still alive. In fact, she'd hugged him around the waist before they'd rode out from Norris, where they'd left her with a family, safe and sound. Once more, she'd called him her hero. Roan shook his head. No, he was not a hero. But that didn't mean he couldn't do something heroic. He could do it again, especially now that he knew his guardian had lied to him about so much. The soldier groaned once more, and Roan squinted in the darkness until the face clarified. A girl, she appeared young, but it was obvious from her coppery hair and orange eyes that she was Orion, so age was a moving target. Still alive, but barely, her face green in the moonlight, already slick with wet snowmelt. Roan gritted his teeth and rolled over, growling through the agony that lanced through his ankle. He reached out and touched her. Light burst from his chest, arcing from him to her, swarming over the metal armor she wore. She gasped, and he could feel what she felt, could feel her injuries, which were deep beneath the surface of her skin. A crushed lung, cracked ribs, a punctured organ. The light knitted her tissue and bones back together, sapping Roan's strength. The girl breathed in and out, and then said, "You saved my life." Roan said nothing. He hadn't done anything. His mark had saved her. He'd done nothing but touched her and made a choice. And now he felt like sleeping, his eyes closing of their own accord. "Healer," the girl said, and he felt her cold hands on his cheeks.
Warm yourself. Repair your leg. There is time. The battle has moved away.
Roan couldn't open his eyes, but he had just enough awareness to concentrate on the heat that still lingered in his chest. He let it drift throughout his body, warming his extremities before settling on his devastated leg. The pain throbbed once, twice, and then vanished. His eyes flashed open, and the forest dweller reached down to help him up. Like all the Aurians, her small stature hid a remarkable amount of strength. She easily pulled him to his feet.
"Thank you," she said. "Be safe."
And then she was gone, sprinting along the trail toward the screams, toward the danger. Roan marveled at the young warrior. Despite having nearly died, she was willing to risk her life again. Even still, he wanted nothing more than to turn around and flee. He was no soldier. She'd called him a healer, but he wasn't that either.
"What am I?"
Roan wondered.
"You are,"
Roan whispered, feeling the words in the mark in his chest.
"You are."
They were right there, so close he could touch them, taste them, hear them echoing in the dark folds of his mind. But still he couldn't say them, couldn't speak the truth. The truth was a dangerous beast, and Roan didn't know what would happen if he uncaged it. Roan breathed deeply, steeling his nerves, which had been severed in half a dozen places. And then he started forward once more, testing the limits of his weary body. Anis. The Easterners burst from the pass, their armor glinting in the red and green moonlight. Though their numbers had clearly been culled while they ran the gauntlet, there were still hundreds of them, swords raised high. Toward the front was a gargantuan man who could only be King Auron Ironclad, the Juggernaut, his famed foe hammer hefted on his shoulder. He shouted something, and his soldiers roared in response. The ice slings released one final volley, huge chunks of ice arcing through the sky and landing amongst the enemy, who scattered like fallen leaves. Several were crushed, but the rest regained their feet and charged toward the north, now well past where the long-distance ice slings would be effective.
"So, this is what it has come to,"
Anise thought. This journey, all started by the death of her father, was on the precipice of fate, and she felt like a single false step could mean the end. Her brother had found his army, and yet his rebellion against their uncle hung in the balance.
"Anise!"
a voice cried now, and a hand grabbed her shoulder from behind. Arch stared at her, his eyes wide.
"You should not be here."
"I tried to stop her, Your Highness,"
Taryn said.
"You are my king," she said, "and my brother, and I will not hide behind an army like a weakling."
For a second it almost looked like Arch might laugh, but instead he offered a thin smile.
"No, my sister. You are anything but weak."
To Anise's surprise, he threw his arms around her and pulled her tight.
"Tonight, we fight together." "For the kingdom,"
she returned, and he kissed her cheek.
"For the kingdom,"
he echoed. And then they charged into battle, their cries lost amongst hundreds of others. Bane. Raiders Pass was already in turmoil when Bane arrived as quietly as a whisper. He could smell death in the air, could hear it in the cries of the warriors who did battle. He sniffed again and smelled something else. Royalty. Bloodlust. Barriers to peace. For who could be blamed for the Hundred Years' War but the leaders who rallied their troops into battle, drunk on their desire for power and conquest? His bare scalp burned with need, a fire for death that had to be sated, or else he would be consumed. Bane blinked, and he moved, not with his feet, but in another unexplainable way. Swords clashed around him. An enormous man wearing dark armor from head to toe swung a black chain ending in a spiked ball in a deadly arc. Twice Bane watched it, as it crashed into the skulls of armored warriors. He could feel their instantaneous deaths deep in his bones, in his marrow, in the black hole that should have been his soul. Another massive man roared and strode forward to face the armored knight.
He was wearing a necklace that bore a strange symbol, an iron fist.
Ah, Bane thought. This man is like me. This man is fate-marked. More specifically, iron-marked.
Armed with the iron mark, the enormous man fought with the strength of 10 men, tossing opponents aside like a child's playthings, closing in on the armored knight. The knight swung his spiked ball at the iron-marked, a heavy stroke so powerful it would kill any man in an instant. But this was no ordinary man. The iron-marked caught the chain in his hand and began to reel the knight toward him. Bane licked his lips as he watched. To see another who was fate-marked was exhilarating, the raw power intoxicating. The massive knight dug his heels into the snow and attempted to stop his progress forward, but his feet slid across the ice. He'd have to release his weapon if he were going to survive the encounter. The large knight was stubborn, however, refusing to give up his spiked ball and chain. The iron-marked grinned as he dragged the knight into his grasp. Bane leaned forward, eager to watch. At the last second, the knight dropped the chain and drove forward low to the ground, tackling the iron-marked around the waist. The large man went down, his head cracking against the hard ground. The knight was remarkably nimble for his size, pushing quickly to his feet, while his opponent's girth caused him to flounder like a turtle on its back. The armored knight snatched up his weapon and whipped it down hard, again and again, on the iron-marked's body, landing blows to his chest, abdomen, legs, and finally his head. The huge man fought the strikes at first, attempting to block them with his thick forearms, but was eventually overcome, his body going still. Someone roared and strode forward, his dark eyes burning with anger. He stared at the iron-marked's body, gripping his long, elaborately forged hammer with white-knuckled fingers. The newcomer was of impressive size, too, though not as large as either his fallen man or the knight he now faced. Bane's death mark pulsed with excitement. This man was a king. From the description Bear Blackboots had given him, it had to be King Orin Ironclad, Juggernaut of the East. A man who had seen many battles, who had chosen war over peace, following in his father's footsteps. A man who had to die. The armored knight's weapon cut through the air, battering the king's armor. But, seemingly fueled by anger for his fallen comrade, the Juggernaut pushed forward, grabbing the chain, yanking it back toward him. The armored knight stumbled as the king swung his hammer at his midsection. There was a raucous clangor as the armor held true, the blow glancing off and past the knight. He swung a huge fist at the king's head, catching him in the temple and dislodging his helmet. The Juggernaut was exposed but not dead, wrenching his hammer back and bringing it down on the knight's neck. This time the armor dented, and when the king landed an elbow to the knight's face, his face mask and helmet popped off like a cork from a bottle of sparkling wine. Finally, tired of being merely a spectator, Bane moved in for the kill. Anis had lost her sword and her brother somewhere in the fray. She'd used her blade to block a slash from an enemy soldier, and then Terin's Morningstar had finished him off. No matter where she'd charged, Terin had been there, his spiked ball protecting her. She'd caught sight of Sir Dietrich several times as well, facing more opponents than should be humanly possible, and yet he always seemed to emerge unscathed, his sword moving with the speed of lightning strikes. Finally, however, after defeating the largest man Anis had ever seen, Terin was locked in battle with the Eastern King himself, who was also nearly as big as the armored knight. The distraction left Anis on her own. A young Easterner burst through the lines and swung at her, but Anis was ready, pretending it was just a wooden sword on the training fields, not a razor-sharp blade of steel. She ducked and threw herself forward, hitting the man in the chest, rocking him backward. She landed on him, and he gasped. Anis took his own sword, which he dropped, and stabbed him between his plates of armor. Like the only other man she'd killed, taking his life seemed too easy, a thought which unnerved her. Still straddling him, she looked up, searching for Terin. Her breath left her when she spotted him. He was face to face with King Ironclad, literally. Both men's helmets had come off, and they were staring each other down. The king's head was bald,
his dark beard long and thick. But that's not why Anis couldn't breathe. She could see Terin's face. Like his hand, his cheeks were so pale they were almost glowing, his skin as thin as stretched silk. Beneath his flesh were long snakes of black, his veins, which protruded in tangled rivulets. The king also seemed shocked by his opponent's appearance, his confidence wavering as they circled each other.
"What manner of northern devilry are you?"
the big man bellowed, holding his mighty hammer in front of him. Terin didn't answer, flicking a glance at Anise, who couldn't stop staring at his face. He looked back at the king, but didn't respond, choosing instead to swing his chain over his head, preparing to strike. Like a cloud of vapour materialising from some unknown netherworld, a form appeared between them. Anise stood, gaping at the familiar boy, his scalp marked with a circle of fire, a quarter portion of the image as dark as Terin's blood. Like the first time she'd seen him, on the tower steps the moment before her father fell to his death, the boy's resemblance to Arch was startling. Terin's morning star slowed and fell harmlessly to his side. He was also staring in wonderment at the boy, Anise's brother, now called Bane, according to her aunt. King's Bane, killer of monarchs, bringer of death. King Ironclad continued to hold his hammer at the ready, eyeing Bane with narrowed eyes. A short blade appeared in Bane's hand, materializing the same way that he had. He stepped forward. The king swung his own weapon in a deadly trajectory, but he caught only empty air. Her brother was gone.
"No," Anise realized. "There."
He was behind the king, his lips a snarl. Seemingly from out of nowhere, a form appeared from the side, sliding his sword in front of the king's back, blocking Bane's killing stroke. At the same moment, Terin whipped his morning star around once more. There was a vicious crunch as the spiked ball landed squarely on the king's exposed head. Anise turned away, trying to blink away the awful image. Not even the massive king could rise from a wound like that one. Roan had managed to work his way through the pass, healing several injured Easterners as he went. His energy was waning, but he refused to stop until he was unconscious. It was strange, but now that he'd begun using his mark more, his body seemed to grow accustomed to the bouts of fatigue, fighting them off and recovering more swiftly. With each person he healed, he felt something burning inside of him, a feeling he couldn't quite pinpoint until he emerged from the canyon and onto open land. That's when he realized what it was that he felt. Purpose. He moved forward, searching for those who were injured but not dead, allowing his mark's energy to range outwards further and further, rainbows of white light illuminating the snowfield. All around him the battle raged, but he ignored it. Twice a northerner tried to remove his head from his shoulders, but each time he'd managed to duck the blow until an ally moved in to protect him. He had a sword, but it hung from his belt, unused. His purpose did not involve killing. It involved saving. Cries began to rise up on all sides.
"Protect the healer!"
He spotted Gwendolyn, and a swell of airy relief filled his lungs. She was fighting like an orcat, felling foes like saplings under an axe, alternating between her bow and her sword, a graceful dance of death. Roan was about to move toward her, just in case she sustained an injury, but then saw Prince Gareth running in the opposite direction. He was screaming at the top of his lungs, his sword pumping beside him. Tracing a line in front of the prince with his eyes, Roan saw the impossible. The king, his enormous frame wobbling, his enormous foe hammer slipping from lifeless fingers, his caved-in head resting like a rotten pumpkin atop his shoulders. He fell. The king fell. Though it was obvious from a distance that even Roan wouldn't be able to save the monarch, he sprinted after Gareth anyway, determination coursing through him. Somewhere in the back of his mind, Roan realized Gareth was now the king, a thought that struck him as exceptionally strange. Near the king's body, Prince Guy was doing battle with a strange adversary. A boy, unarmored,
wearing nothing more than a black cloak, stabbed at the prince with short, rapid strikes. Guy was barely able to block them, backpedaling against the ferocious onslaught. Gareth was closing in, and Roan knew exactly what the new king had in mind. He was planning to protect his brother, not only with his sword, but with his body, becoming the human shield he was born to be. Despite all the trouble the prince had caused him, despite all the mockery and the threats and the taunts, despite how he'd rejected his kiss, Roan couldn't let him die. Not today. This was why he was here. He sprinted, hurdling the dead, dodging those locked in battle. The boy knocked Prince Guy's sword away. He swung a final blow toward his throat. Gareth tried to dive in front to block the killing stroke, but Guy was already falling, his neck slashed open. The boy tossed him aside and plunged his blade deep into Gareth's chest. Roan didn't stop, couldn't stop, rushing forward and diving at the prince, who was lying on the cold, hard ground, blood bubbling from his armor and his lips.
"No," Roan breathed. "You're not dying on me. You're not."
He reached for the prince, but a strong arm grabbed his hand and pulled it back. The boy, his skin pale and smooth and free of hair, neither stubble nor eyebrow nor lash.
"I smell it on you," the boy said,
as Roan struggled against his grip, which was like iron.
"You are not supposed to be here."
Roan didn't care what the boy smelled, but for once he disagreed with the notion that he shouldn't be in this place at this time.
"I am," he said,
his mark flaring to life. The boy released him and cringed, backing away.
"No,"
he said.
"Impossible. You can't be both."
"Both what?" Roan said. For the first time since the battle began, he slid his sword from his scabbard. For the first time since the battle began, he considered the fact that he might need to kill in order to save. The light in his chest moved along his arm and into the blade, which sparkled like a sunlit icicle.
"A king and the peacemaker," the boy said,
launching himself forward. Roan blocked the blow with his sword, which pulsed with white light, pushing back against the darkness that seemed to surround the boy and his blade like a shadow. Roan didn't care who this boy was or what he knew. He wouldn't let him get to Prince Gareth, who was running out of time. He shoved back with all his might, and the boy vanished into the cold night air. Behind him, the prince gurgled, choking on his own blood. Roan whirled around and pressed his hands to Gareth's blood-soaked cheek. Too late. The new king was dead, following his father and brother too soon. Roan looked up, blinking away the tears in his eyes before they froze on his cheeks. So many dead. Lives ended too soon. For what purpose? To what end?
"If my fate is to be here, to witness this," Roan thought, "it is a cruel fate."
Beyond the dead, he saw a strong-looking woman, curvy and muscular, looking his way, watching as he huddled over the fallen kings. There was something about the determined look in her eyes that gave him pause. No, it was something else about her. Her cheekbones, or the slight tilt of her nose. Something familiar. She looked away, her attention drawn to something else. Roan peered back down at where his hand continued to rest on Gareth's cheek. He felt something pulse, there and gone again, a flash of the very thing that had driven his every act since he entered Raider's Pass. Life. The mark on his chest burst forth with what energy he had left. Bane. Bane's body was buzzing with electricity from his encounter with the Peacemaker. Too soon. The Western Oracle's prophecy allowed for the death of 8 rulers before he would do battle with the Peacemaker. And nothing in the prophecy stated the Peacemaker would be a king. But he was. That much was obvious. Bane reappeared a distance away from the battle, beginning to feel weak from using his mark. His scalp was still hot, and he could feel a fourth section of his death mark begin to fill with blood. The third was already blood-soaked, from when the Juggernaut had died. Bane wished he'd been the one to kill Orion Ironclad, But dead was dead. At least he'd killed the eldest son of King Ironclad, the one named Gareth. The moment his father had died, he'd become king. A short-lived reign, to say the least. Wait. Wait. Somewhere across the killing fields, a brilliant white pulse shot from the ground toward the heavens. A column of pure light. He could feel the death throb in his scalp begin to subside, his skin cooling rapidly, the blood draining from the fourth section of his mark. And he knew. He knew. The King Peacemaker had managed to save King Gareth Ironclad, ruler of the Eastern Kingdom, from death's grip. Despite the weakness settling into his bones, the night was not over. Not until more royal blood had been spilt. The armored knight with the black blood had killed a king, but Bane had not. King Gareth was out of reach, but another was not, the lawful northern ruler. He disappeared, and when he emerged from the fabric of life, a young man barely older than he stood before him, staring, his mouth opened slightly. There was no mistaking the similarity in appearance. The man who thought he was the king was his brother. Anise was forced to use her hand to shield her eyes against the light, which was so bright it was as if the sun itself had fallen from the sky and crashed into the earth. The light came from the man she'd seen staring at her. He was with the Easterners, but was so different in appearance from them that she couldn't help but to stare back. He reminded her of the Westerners, his sunshine golden hair long and lustrous. He reminded her of her mother. The light vanished, and Anise was left blinking away white spots and her foolish thoughts. Why would a Westerner be here now? And no Westerner would be caught dead in the company of an Eastern army. They hated each other more than the North hated both of them. She had no idea what sort of sorcery the light was, but she didn't particularly care at the moment, not when Bane was still on the loose somewhere. Bane appeared again, this time in front of Arch.
No, she thought. Not him. Not my brothers.
Who are you?
Arch said, taking a step forward, his voice full of awe.
Arch!
Anise called out, but he didn't react, unable to tear his gaze away.
I am Bane, the boy said. I am your brother.
His black pinprick eyes flicked between Arch and Anise, as if speaking to them both. Anise shuddered as Zelda's tale of her lost brother came back to her. This boy had killed her father, and if he was truly the king's bane, more would fall to him before the prophecy of the king's plague was fulfilled. Starting with Arch. Bane strode forward, grabbing Arch by the collar, lifting him effortlessly into the air. Arch struggled against the smaller boy, one brother locked against another. One she knew as well as herself, and one she barely knew at all. Arch managed to take a swipe at his brother, who merely dodged the blow.
Stop, Bane growled. Stay out of this. You don't have to die.
Anise took a step forward, cocking her head to the side. Realization swarmed like angry bees. Bane wasn't here for Arch, because Arch wasn't the true king. By northern law, she was the ruler. She was the queen. Her lost brother was here for her. Arch took another swing at Bane, who blocked it with his blade, slinging his brother to the ground. Breathing heavily, Arch leapt up and fought back with all the skill he could muster. Her heart hammering, Anise charged toward the duo, praying she'd make it in time.
I don't want to kill you!
Bane roared, shoving Arch back once more. Anise was 10 steps away, 5. With fresh determination, Arch attacked, his blows quick enough to disarm most opponents. But Bane wasn't most opponents. He blocked each strike and then attacked, his blade sinking into Arch's gut at the same moment Anise bashed into him with her shoulder. They went down in a tangle of arms and legs, his blade swinging wildly, slashing her hip open.
She pinned him to the ground, but he bucked, as strong as an ice bear, throwing her aside like she was a dainty princess and not a broad-shouldered queen. He bared his teeth and leapt upon her, and she knew she was dead. Until an enormous black shape eclipsed everything, standing before her. Terin, the back of his pale head snaking with dark veins, swung his morning star at the king's bane. Bane dodged the blow and stepped inside its arc, punching the knight's armor with his small fist. The sound was so loud, Anise thought the earth itself might be cracking open. Terin flew backwards over her, skidding to a stop.
"I'm sorry, sister," Bane said. "I cannot resist it. Not any more. This land needs a chance to heal, to start over. Father had to die, and now you do, too."
Anise wouldn't fight back. Not against her own brother, no matter what he was. This was the brother she'd mourned as a child. The brother she'd lost. He hadn't chosen his life any more than she'd chosen hers. She didn't know if Arch was dead or not, but if he was alive, he would be king after she was gone, and she knew he'd be a good one. But Sir Dietrich had other ideas. His armor dented and splattered with blood that Anise suspected was not his own, the knight stepped forward to face her youngest brother.
"Don't hurt him," she pleaded, struggling back to her feet.
She didn't know who she was speaking to. Maybe both of them. Bane ignored her. He sprang forward, his blade moving faster than Anise's eyes could follow. And yet each slash was met with an even faster block by Sir Dietrich, whose sword almost seemed to separate itself from his grip, moving of its own volition. It was impossible. Even when Bane disappeared and reappeared several times behind the knight, Sir Dietrich managed to whirl and deflect his attacks. No swordsman in the Four Kingdoms was that good. Not naturally, anyway. Bane took a blow to the shoulder, and he roared, clutching his skin as blood poured between his fingers. He seemed shocked, his mouth agape. Another slash of Sir Dietrich's sword forced the boy back, and he stumbled, falling to the ground. His body was beginning to shake, racked with tremors. Sir Dietrich stood over her trembling brother, sword held high. Anise threw herself at the knight, knocking him aside as his sword came down. There was a meaty thump and a cry, and as she landed, Anise turned her head to look back. Sir Dietrich's sword was stuck in the ground, Bane having rolled away. The knight was glaring at her, dumbfounded.
"What was that?"
he growled.
"You were going to. I couldn't. I had to."
Anise started and stopped and started again, none of the words sounding quite right in her head. Beyond the knight, Bane had regained his feet, though his knife was missing and he was swaying from side to side. He was no longer clutching his shoulder, which bled freely. He looked as surprised as Sir Dietrich at what Anise had done.
"Why?"
he said breathlessly.
"Because you're my brother,"
Anise said. Bane's lips parted slightly, and then closed. A moment later he was gone. This time he didn't reappear, gone to another place, to which, Anise suspected, she could not follow. Ignoring Sir Dietrich's dark stare, Anise pushed to her feet and ran toward where Terin had gone down earlier. She found the knight on his back, his eyes closed, his chest plate dented where her brother had punched him.
"Terin,"
she said, ignoring the strangeness of his skin, which was too thin, too stretched. She cupped his chin.
"Terin?"
When he didn't respond, she felt beneath his nostrils for breath. She felt something, but didn't know if it was her imagination or the wind or air from the knight's lungs.
"Please, Terin,"
she said.
"I know I haven't always been the easiest traveling companion, but I..." "I what? What am I trying to say?"
The truth whispered through her heart.
"I need you. You are my hope, Flower, and I need you."
His eyes fluttered open, and she let out a quick gasp of relief. He smiled, though it was weak.
"Have you seen my helmet?"
he asked. Anise laughed and sank back into a drift.
For a long time, she stared at the snowfall, which hung like pale stars in the sky. 35. The Northern Kingdom, Silent Mountain. Bane. He'd tried to kill her, and she'd saved his life. His sister. The Queen. He'd seen it in her eyes, a miasma of emotions, each trying to gain advantage. Regret, hope, sorrow, love, anger. Anger, yes. That he understood. Sorrow and regret, too, perhaps. Hope? Love? Those were foreign to him, as impossibly distant as the shores of the burning sea. His shoulder was throbbing, his skin slick with blood. But that was only pain, of little concern to the king's bane. Though he'd lost his dagger, he had others. Sitting by the fire, he picked one up and thrust its blade into the flames, which were still crackling happily. Once the blade was sufficiently hot, he pulled it out and touched the broad side to his broken flesh, a flare of agony shooting through his arm as his skin sizzled. A moment later, his wound was sealed. It would heal eventually, which was more than he could say about the invisible tears in the fabric of his mind. Dropping the dagger, he curled and uncurled his fingers, taking deep breaths. He'd grown used to the feeling after, though he wouldn't be able to stand if he tried. He lowered his head slowly to the ground, sighing with weariness. That's when he noticed something. Bear was gone. Not just out. Gone. None of the large man's scant possessions remained. Both sets of his boots had been taken. All of his fur-lined clothing. Near the fire, a freshly stacked pile of moist firewood stood, drying in the heat. 6 jugs of melting snow were lined up nearby. Recently carved meat hung from the ceiling, slowly being smoked. Bear was gone.
"Father,"
Bane murmured.
"Father, why?"
He'd been abandoned. He had no one. He was death, and death was forced to walk paths of shadow and isolation. He released the last of his energy through his throat, between his lips, his cry of anger and sorrow and pain, and utter aloneness, roaring from the mouth of the cave, startling a white owl who was perched on a scraggly tree on the mountainside. When he had no sound left inside him, Bane closed his eyes, still clutching the dagger between blood-stained fingers. He had nothing left but a prophecy about him.
8 rulers must die. 8. No more, no less. I cannot fail. This is my purpose. 3 dead. 5 to go.
Though he didn't trust himself to face his sister in the north again, not this soon, he had no qualms about cleansing the other kingdoms. He'd start as far away from the north as he could get. Not that he had a choice, because he already knew where he would be called to next. Yes. As soon as he'd recovered, Bane would leave the only home he'd ever known. The Southern Empire would be the next to fulfill the Oracle's prophecy. 36. The Eastern Kingdom, south of Raiders Pass. Rhone. Over the last few weeks, Rhone had awoken in a number of strange places. Now, in darkness, he awoke in chains. He squinted against the light of an approaching torch. Voices rumbled nearby, but he couldn't understand them, his ears still ringing with the clash of swords and rumble of timber cascading down a mountainside. He remembered the light flowing from his chest, splitting the sky in half. The voices clarified.
"How many dead?" one asked.
"Prince Grian." A memory stirred in Rhone's mind. Prince Skye's throat cut wide open as he tumbled to the ground.
"The tally isn't finished," another voice replied.
One of the platoon commanders, hardy, ironclad, a cousin to the 3 princes.
"But the numbers have already stretched over 4,000. Our army was only 5,000.
"Yes," Hardy agreed.
The enemy lost only a third of our number. The rest retreated toward Gearhead. The northern force seemed smaller than we expected. It was. Our scouts have returned from their northern expedition. They bring word of a girl resembling Anise Gehrig, riding with the army. Anise Gehrig? The princess was supposed to be in hiding, along with her brother.
Hardy shook his head.
Apparently not. And the army was small because it was nothing more than a group of rebels who are planning to take back the throne from Lord Griswold.
We were defeated by a group of rebels,
Gryan scoffed.
The king was killed. My brother was killed.
They were well prepared,
Hardy said.
We lost many through the pass. Also, there was...
His lips hung open, unspoken words crowding inside his mouth. Gryan nodded, as if reading the commander's mind.
What was that thing?
He asked. Roan immediately knew who, what, he meant. The boy cloaked in shadow. The boy who'd slashed open Guy's throat and stabbed Gareth in the chest.
Your father,
Hardy started to say.
My father is dead,
Prince Gryan snarled.
You think I don't know that?
Hardy said, glaring at the prince.
He was my uncle, but I loved him like a father, too. My father was the shield, remember? He saved your father's life once.
Roan peered between half-closed lids at the two, wondering where Gareth was. He isn't dead, he reasoned with himself. I felt the life still inside of him. I poured everything I had left into him. But what if it wasn't enough? The prince and the commander glared at each other for a few long moments before their expressions softened simultaneously.
I can't believe the Juggernaut is dead,
Hardy said.
I thought the old man was invincible,
Gryan agreed.
It was that cursed knight,
Hardy said.
Did you see his flesh? It looked dead. His blood was black. The northerners are practicing dark magic. Sorcery. He almost killed Stonesledge, too. No human man could have done that.
He almost killed Stonesledge. The iron-marked warrior had somehow managed to survive the battle, despite his grievous injuries.
We will have our revenge,
Gryan said. A third person arrived, her slender figure a shadow, backlit by the torchlight.
Ho, Gryan. Hardy,
Gwendolyn said by way of greeting.
How is Gareth?
Gryan asked.
You mean the king?
Gryan grimaced.
I am the king. My brother is in no position to rule. It should have been Guy, but instead the responsibility falls to me.
Gwen sighed, as if she was already tired of dealing with the prince. She didn't argue the point.
He is alive, but weak. Roan managed to stave off the worst of Gareth's wounds. But his injuries were grievous, and Roan lost strength before repairing them all. It will take him time to recover, but recover he will. And then he will be king. Gareth is alive,
Roan thought, his eyes flashing open.
I saved him. He was supposed to die, and I saved him anyway.
His chains rattled as he tried to lift his arms.
Where is he?
He groaned.
I can heal him the rest of the way. My strength is back, mostly.
Gryan stood over him. There was no kindness in his eyes. Gwen hung back. Roan tried to catch her gaze, but she wouldn't look at him. He'd never seen her look so uncertain.
Who are you, really?
Gryan asked.
Not your normal nonsense about not knowing your father and your Southron mother. The truth. Now.
When Roan hesitated, fumbling for a way to explain a long story in just a few words, Gryan drew his sword and shoved the tip under Roan's chin.
Cousin,
Hardy cautioned. Gwen said,
Remember, he saved Gareth.
Gareth was the shield. He was not meant to be saved. The wrong brother died.
If Roan wasn't in chains, he might have tried to hit the prince. In the face. Hard. Traditions be damned. No man should have to die simply because he was born first.
Fate disagreed with you,
he said instead.
Your words are as dusty as your lineage. You are the enemy,
Gryan said, glaring at Roan, who was too scared to breathe, fearing the movement might puncture his neck on the blade. Turning toward the Orion, Gryan added,
"You said it yourself."
"I said nothing," Gwen said. "I merely told you what I overheard the strange boy say." Hardy pulled on the prince's shoulder, and Gryan finally retracted his blade. Roan breathed deeply, his heart thudding in his chest.
"My father is—"
he started to say. But Gwen cut him off.
"Your father was King Gil Loren, ruler of the Western Kingdom. You have three siblings, Rhea, Bea, and Leo. Your aunt was Sabria Loren, executed by Lord Griswold. Her daughter and son, Anise Gerrick and Arch Gerrick, lawful heirs to the Northern Throne, are your cousins. It is said they fought bravely at Raiders Pass, and Anise was seen retreating under her own strength. Arch was injured, but is presumed to be alive." Roan was stunned. She must have heard what the boy had said and connected the dots. There were lots of dots to connect, but then again, she'd lived a long time.
"Which now, under Western law, makes you the Western King," Hardy said. "Roan Loren, our sworn enemy," Gryan added. "All this time you were right under our thumbs, marching along beside us, trading quips with Gareth and Gwen. We should kill you now."
His blade gleamed in the light, reflecting the deadly glint in his eyes.
"No," Gwen said, "you cannot. He has great value as a ransom."
Her eyes caught Roan's, and there was a gleam in them that belied her words.
She's lying, he realized.
And for the first time since he'd met her, he could tell she really saw him.
"You don't give orders," Gryan said.
"Your father respected my counsel enough to listen."
Gryan's lips went tight, but he didn't argue further.
"We will discuss King Roan's fate soon enough," the prince said. "Keep an eye on him."
Gryan and Hardy left, carrying the torch with them, presumably off to check on Gareth's condition. Roan wanted to follow them, but his chains were secured to a stake driven deep into the ground.
"Gareth is alive," Roan breathed.
Under the moon and starlight, he could just make out Gwen's profile in the dark.
"Because of you,"
Roan nodded.
"Maybe you're rubbing off on me."
Gwen didn't laugh, her eyes dark and serious.
"That strange boy called you the peacemaker."
Roan shook his head, but it wasn't an answer.
"Yes, but I don't know what that means."
"You swear it?"
"You know far more than me about the marks. I never even knew about the Western Oracle until you told me."
Gwen chewed on his words for a moment, seeming to contemplate them. She sighed.
"My father always believed the marks were of greater importance than most people thought. Not just because of the power they gave the bearers, but because of the role they might play in the fate of the Four Kingdoms. He often searched the Eastern libraries for information, but alas, the ironclads have never been particularly scholarly. The shelves were full of thin volumes, with naught more than the occasional reference to the Western Oracle's teachings. I do, however, remember him speaking of the peacemaker, who had come to save the Four Kingdoms."
"Too bad her words are just words," Roan thought, "and I am just a man." Then again, he was a man who, for the first time in his life, was unafraid of his fate and the mark he bore on his chest. He was no longer a slave to his past. Maybe he never was. Something told him his story wasn't over, not yet, and if he'd simply turn the page, the next chapter would begin.
"I am no savior," he said.
"No, you are not," Gwen agreed.
"I am no hero either."
"Perhaps not.
But heroes are not born, they are grown. Each choice is a drop of water, each experience a ray of sunlight. They grow day by day, until they are the tallest tree in the forest, willing to protect all who live under their shadow. I fear I'm naught but a sapling at this point. The wind blows and I bend to the ground. And yet I was wrong about you. You are no coward, either."
"Thank you," I will remind you of that as oft as I have the opportunity. Before she could respond, he said, I've been thinking more about the marks. Isn't it strange that those who bear the marks are born in the very places that their particular powers are most suited to?